The Lutheran theologian George Limbeck was an official observer at Vatican II, living in Rome from 1962 to 1964 and attending all the conciliar sessions. Three decades later, Limbeck recalled that this came about after Pope St. John XXIII asked for three observers apiece from each of the world confessional organizations, and the Lutheran World Federation decided, this is Limbeck's words, decided they had to name an American as one of the three observers. The American would have to know Latin, German, and French, would have to have some experience of Roman Catholic theology, and would have to get a leave of absence from his regular job. They scraped and scraped the barrel, Limbeck explained. And at the bottom, there was an untenured Yale teacher whose dean and department were not bound by the draconian faculty employment rules now in effect. As for other participant observers, Vatican II was for Limbeck not only a massive wodge of documents, but an event. These 3 years in Rome were powerfully influential for Limbeck. They launched the young, green, untenured Yale professor into his career as the godfather of narrative theology. At the same time, the young teacher interpreted the council and gathered its bays according to his own inner lights, the lights of a budding narrative theologian. What gripped Limbeck about the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world was its this-worldly eschatology. Limbeck thought the eschatological paradigm of Gaudium et Spes was new and fresh, differing from anything the church had seen since the time of the Reformation. The difference which Limbeck thought this made is quite astonishing. In 1965, Limbeck claimed that the eschatological framework that emerges in the drafts of Gaudium et Spes constituted such an earthquake of a paradigm shift that it erased the chasm between Protestants and Catholics. Despite setbacks to the ecumenical movement and the receding of the goal of full sacramental reunion, Limbeck never abandoned this intuition that the eschatological framework of Gaudium et Spes just reframed everything so far that the Reformation was over, and he said so in those words. Limbeck's interpretation, in my opinion, of Gaudium et Spes is a creative misreading of the event of the promulgation of this constitution and of the text itself. He misread the event in the sense that he overstates the novelty of the church's venture into eschatology. He thinks it's a radical departure from Tridentine tradition that the Catholics should be relating the movement of secular history to the construction of the City of God. But anti-liberal popes from Gregory XVI to Pius X and on to Leo XIII had used the proximity of the City of God to the City of Man to lash the church to the establishment. The 19th century popes used the requirement of harmony between the two cities against the Catholic liberals who yearned for disestablishment of the church. This goes together in the document with an acknowledgement of the tension between the cities. Limbeck never seems to have tasted the large dose of paradox in the Constitution. The Constitution's claim that the history remains a struggle and a fight between the powers of darkness and the sons of light. After much dining and cigar smoking amongst the French clerics, Limbeck saw that the struggle and the fight between the old scholastics and the new theologians, he must have dined and wined with both sides, and they were each trying to get him onto their side, I think, profoundly rooted in diverse allegiances during the occupation and the Second World War. The old Thomists were anti-liberals like the 19th century popes. They wanted the church to speak for the common good, the natural law, and the common man. They saw liberalism, on the other hand, as serving the elite. but they saddled their humanistic political theory with a bit pessimistic determination to attach the church to the forces of political reaction and real politic, for whom the deadly foe is utopianism. So much for the old Thomists. The agenda of the new theologians was to toss out neo-scholastic anti-utopianism and root Catholic social anthropology in a natural desire for the supernatural God. In Gaudium et Spes, both sides win. The Thomists get their common good, a natural law, and a thoroughgoing rejection of any kind of European-style liberalism. And the new theologians get to found their social anthropology in a Christ-haunted utopianism, which is driven by the desire for God to build a new Jerusalem. It goes without saying that it's cheating to sum up Gaudium et Spes in one or two paragraphs. That's the real, authentically or properly interpreted constitution of the church in the modern world, and then tell you how Lynn Beck misread it. I realize that's cheating. But for all I know, I misread it too, just now, and less creatively than Lynn Beck. So, in this paper, I will lay out Lynn Beck's interpretation of Schema 17, 13, and so on as they unfold into Gaudium et Spes. Because sometimes in the papers I read you, Lynn Beck is talking about Schema 13. You know, he published things before Gaudium et Spes was out, because he was on the spot. So when I talk about that, these are the the forerunners of Gaudium et Spes that sometimes he's talking about. Not everyone seized on eschatology as the driving force of the pastoral constitution, and Lynn Beck was right to do so. The fact that he did so was because it's there, but it's also because eschatology gave Lynn Beck the new look on Pauline Christianity, which narrative theology requires. So he saw it really is there, and it enabled him to launch his narrative theology, but he also slightly misread it. That is my view. So I'll get chopping with this, and then later on I'll come back to the question of readings and misreadings. So that was my introduction, you see. I just said everything. I'm going to say more later on in a quick sort of overview. Okay, that's an overview of the whole paper. So if you didn't understand it, don't worry. I'm going to say it again and again and again. Okay, so second point here now, Lynn Beck's initial reaction to Gaudium et Spes. Lynn Beck's earliest reaction to Gaudium et Spes, his initial responses were in French, you see, because he's sitting around with all these French clerics chatting. And so, to my knowledge, very few of these pieces have been translated in full. And I was astonished reading it in French, and I kept looking for a missing ne pas when I read these paragraphs, which I... And I'm not leaving in any ellipses at all. You know, I'm not quietly removing any plus maintenance or pas encore. No ellipses in what I read, but 1965, when the pastoral constitution is still Schema 13, Lynn Beck described how the document changes Protestant-Catholic relations. He says, when we employ eschatological categories in the way the schema does, particularly as combined with the personalist and existentialist vision of the historicity of human life, the ancient theological conflicts about sola fide and sola gratia, about free will and predestination, sin and concupiscence, purely and simply disappear. The ancient theological conflicts about sola fide and sola gratia purely and simply disappear. For Catholics as well as Protestants retrieve the biblical vision of salvation as a passage from the old age to the new age, a passage from slavery to demonic powers to the freedom of the sons of God. Deliverance from that fixation on the past, which leads to attempts at self-justification to open the future to God. There is no way one could debate the old problems in the terms of that individualism which we have inherited from Augustine, and which by itself gave a meaning to those disputes, like the ones about infused grace and extrinsic imputation. So he thinks that the documents have abandoned that old individualism. This mounting of the individualism of the Western tradition draws our attention to a second domain, that of ecclesial reunion. Not only the Bible, but also history and sociology have rendered us more conscious of the social nature of man than one could have been with Aristotle and his time, Whoever concerns himself with an authentically personal life becomes a being who is profoundly preoccupied with social context. It is only by means of that which can be transmitted in and through the Christian community that a person can become consciously and actively a member of the body of Christ. The church, as a communion, as a community, is a mother to all of us, our mother country, and that is why her living continuity, her Catholicity, and her unity are of utmost importance. So Lynn Beck states boldly that the eschatological communio theology of Schema 13 renders ecumenical divisions obsolete, and that as a result the benchmarks of the Lutheran Reformation, faith alone, grace alone, predestination, cease to matter, because we're looking at these things in a new context, out of a eschatological communio theology without the old individualism and so forth. So one can only imagine that Lindbeck sees the pastoral constitution's focus on historical eschatology as a resetting of the picture of the human person, so that the old introspective questions, questions which arise from the examination of a person's interiority and conscience, evaporate. A new eschatological picture of man emerges, in which human beings are always already active in history, always oriented towards the future eschaton, and are understood not as individuals who are preoccupied with the salvation of their own private souls, but as a collective humanity preoccupied with the social construction of the earthly city. And in this new context, the Reformation divides no longer matter, because they're about things that happen inside individuals. That's what he says in those words. So, now on to my third point, a reading and a misreading. Gaudium et Spes reiterates the social teaching of the Church of the past few centuries, especially its concern for the common good. It describes the natural law which governs the morality of social and political endeavor in terms of the human vocation or calling. So here I'm glad to be in agreement with my previous speakers. In keeping with many statements in earlier Catholic social teaching, Gaudium et Spes notes as part of the human vocation to relate and bind the city of man to the city of God. The encyclical thus states that while earthly progress must be carefully distinguished from the growth of Christ's kingdom, to the extent that earthly progress can contribute to the better ordering of society, it is a vital concern to the city of God. So the pastoral constitution schools us in presenting human effort to create a better world in eschatological terms. The church, it says, has a saving and eschatological purpose which can be fully attained only in the future world. But she is already present in this world and is composed of men, of members of the earthly city, who have a core calling, vocation, role to form the family of God's children. So Gaudium et Spes here speaks of a proleptic intermingling of the future synthesis of the earthly and heavenly cities. It instructs us that the presence of the New Jerusalem within the city of man is visible only to the eyes of faith. That the earthly and the heavenly city penetrate each other is a fact accessible to faith alone. It remains a mystery of human history. The Constitution disparages spiritual selfishness or hiving off into one's own private hope of heaven. The Constitution would not have us think of ourselves as resident aliens alone. Quote, this council exhorts Christians as citizens of two cities to strive to discharge their earthly duties conscientiously and in response to the gospel spirit. They are mistaken who, knowing that we have here no abiding city, think that they may therefore shirk their earthly responsibilities. For they are forgetting that by faith itself they are more obliged than ever to measure up to these duties, each according to his proper vocation. So Catholic theologians of the time recognized that Gaudium et Spes, so to speak, eschatologizes and to some extent historicizes traditional Catholic thinking about nature and grace, turning human nature into an active, constructive future orientation, and grace as a historically future fulfillment of that orientation. Edward Schillerbach wrote in 1967, that with the pastoral constitution, the old abstract conundrums about nature and grace become a problem set out in terms of the relations that unite earthly expectation and the eschatological kingdom. Or, as Henri de Lubac put it in a stylistically typical rhetorical flourish, do not Gadamer's Bay's expressions such as growth of the rain or sketch of the age to come seem to suggest a connection between man's final end and the things of the temporal order and of earthly society? He asks. And the answer is obviously yes. So Lindbeck's reading of Gadamer's Bay's is based on this central eschatological thread. Writing when the document was still Schema 13, Lindbeck is impressed by the conciliar document's cosmic Christology, which seems to him, quote, to suggest that the building up of the earthly city is a participation in the cosmic redemptive activity of Christ. Lindbeck warmed to what he called its eschatological dynamism. The document's teaching that the redeemed must communicate their hope of final eschatological deliverance by earthly agencies and conditions rocked Lindbeck's chimes. Like Schillerbach's, Lindbeck recognized that the Schema to some extent reframes the old adage that grace fulfills nature in a new kind of framework of historical futuristic conception of fulfillment. As Lindbeck reads the Schema, it exhorts the Christian to throw himself wholeheartedly into the building of the earthly city, just because the faithful citizen thereby prepares the conditions for the final coming of the kingdom. Lindbeck is taken with the non-chiliastic millennialism of the conciliar imagination. He is taken with its rebaptizing of the Joachimite image of the first fruits of the New Jerusalem sprouting in a renewed earth here below. He's taken with its recovery of Irenaeus's this worldly eschatology. Lindbeck is turned on to sit at the feet of the conciliar fathers and be told that human advancement, even in scientific domains, is not irrelevant to the Christian's hope, but it is in some sense a direct preparation for the final fulfillment, for the ultimate manifestation of the kingdom of God. But again, that's quoting from Lindbeck. So, he was very, very taken with this, but even so, between 65 and 67, Lindbeck stated, fair and square, that progress delivers both cures for hitherto incurable diseases and the atomic bomb. Lindbeck knew that progress is not linear, but always doubles back on itself. He knew also that we do not necessarily know what counts as progress. We do not know what, in our earthly ascent, is contributing to laying the foundations of the New Jerusalem. We don't know what is a wrecking ball knocking the New Jerusalem back down again. But Lindbeck does not think our lack of knowledge of what counts as progress matters any more, his example, than the fact that the Greeks and the Romans didn't know that their cultural achievements were preparation for the gospel mattered to the fact that they're able to prepare for the gospel without knowing they were doing it. We may be preparing for the New Jerusalem without knowing that we're doing it, according to Lindbeck. Lindbeck claims that the world is not getting better in any unambiguous way, any more than it was in the thousands of years before Christ. And yet, perhaps, even our ambiguous secular achievements are being used by God to prepare the way for the consummation, just as he used the Greeks and the Romans to prepare for the coming of the kingdom in the person of Jesus. Lindbeck also acknowledges that what he sees as the Schema's focus on eschatology and the future good of humanity can, quote, distract attention from the one thing necessary, how the individual stands between himself and the Lord of history. So self-deprecatingly, Lindbeck assigns this concern for the relation between the individual and Christ to the Reformation and to a negative aspect of the Reformation. Lindbeck already has the social anthropology of his later famous work on doctrine, and he thinks it's negative just to think in terms of the individual and Christ, and he blames himself. He says, oh, we Protestants shouldn't have ever thought like that. He concedes the individual and his immortal soul to Catholic humanitarianism, which he thinks is better. He invents a rhetorical question of his own. Catholics can justifiably ask us whether we have not so individualized, personalized, and existentialized the forgiveness of sins that we have forgotten its objective ontological and cosmic dimensions. Catholics can ask us whether we have not so much emphasized faith that we have neglected hope. So he just cheerfully concedes the individual dimension, and he thinks eschatological social fulfillment is just much more important. Lindbeck has three levels of explanation of why Protestants and Catholics should give their enthusiastic assent to the eschatologism of Gaudium et Spes. Three reasons why the conciliar joy and hope is a good thing. One is that the constitution on the church in the modern world has assimilated the historicization of modern human consciousness. Modern people, Lindbeck claims, seek transcendence in and through history. They envisage that which transcends them as being before them, ahead of them instead of above them, he thinks. And so Lindbeck here seems to be saying that the Constitution has a biblical eschatology. And that's great. It has a biblical eschatology because that's historical, and that's how modern people think. So he seems to advocate what he calls the authentically biblical eschatology, not especially on the grounds that it's biblical, but because this orientation to seek fulfillment in the future resonates with how modern people experience their being in the world. He thinks it's resonant. So the great thing is, this is a biblical eschatology, and that's great because it's actually how moderns experience their reality. So the point one in favor of the eschatologism of the pastoral constitution is that it vibes with modernity. Lindbeck writes that biblical eschatology has not won the field because theologians believe themselves faithful to the witness of Scripture. Rather, its success must be attributed to the fact that the New Testament eschatology takes on in a modern perspective a meaning it did not have in the classical perspective. And so it can return to the center in a way that hope, the foretaste, and the opening to the future salvation that God prepares for the whole world can become once more a dimension and a source of Christian faith and love. It is this renewal of biblical eschatology, bound to the modern sense of the historical character of existence, which furnishes the new common framework which will matter to both Catholic and Protestant theology in the times to come. These are my translations of Lindbeck, speaking in 65 and 67. I'm taking two pieces that he wrote then. Secondly, very much in tune with classical Lindbeckian concerns, Lindbeck notes that this language of eschatology allows for an eschatological empirical verification. Lindbeck notes that the only language which makes sense for the modern pragmatist is a language open to empirical verification. And eschatological language is proleptically verifiable. This was a big thing, you know, it was a big get-out clause in the 1960s. They all said, oh, well, this is eschatologically verifiable. Lindbeck bought that sort of thing. It's remarkable how many Protestants and Lutherans of the 1960s brought into this Hegelian model of truth, but I have to say they did. Thirdly, and mostly most important, Lindbeck proposes then in 1970 that the eschatological orientation of the social teaching of Gaudium et Spes means it presents the good to be achieved by humanity. It presents the good not propositionally, but in terms of the story. Conciliar eschatology makes the social teaching of the Constitution take a story form. It enables a document to conceive of the world not in terms of endless sameness, not in terms of a Greek two-story propositional model, but, quote, as a story of God's creative and redemptive action and man's ever-new responses. So he likes the whole eschatological framework of the doctrine because it's a story. It's very interesting. I wonder if it even just gave him the whole notion of theological story. One of the things that gave him that notion comes from Gaudium et Spes. So Limbeck is able to claim that the eschatological perspective of Gaudium et Spes, itself a model of historical thinking, relativizes the traditional disputes between Protestants and Catholics, making those disputes of their time, beaching them like old ships and sails in the 16th century. The historical perspective espoused by the pastoral constitution enables us to see, according to Limbeck, that the erstwhile antagonisms of Catholics and Protestants are, quote, more complementary than contradictory. So Limbeck's immediate response to Schema 13 was to propose that it renders the introspective minutiae of Catholic-Protestant conflict obsolete. He offered as his personal conclusion that in the contemporary eschatological historical framework of thought, it becomes difficult to develop a complete and solid theological justification of Protestantism and of Catholicism as they now are, meaning as two opposed versions of Christianity. Limbeck felt that even at the heart of history, and without speaking of the reconciliation for which we hope at the end of time, we are constrained to aspire to one church, to pray for one church, which would be simultaneously Catholic and Reformed. We can live proleptically now in the reunited church, which has yet to materialize, but which Christians hope will be the ground of our enterprise. So the future reunion of Christendom is at the root of our ecumenical project, because it's proleptically always there. That's what Limbeck seems to say. So it is prepared, it is fascinating to observe the extent to which the father of narrative theology is prepared to immolate all the traditional Lutheran concerns on the altar of eschatology. Limbeck got colder feet as the years drew on, didn't we all? And by 1970, he is able to observe that the old classical or vertical perspective is still there in Gaudium et Spes alongside the historical eschatological. But I do not think Limbeck ever drew back from the insights he formed upon his first dizzying gaze into Catholic eschatology. Now, so far, you know, I think Limbeck is onto something with grasping this eschatological dynamism which is going on in Gaudium et Spes. And so far, so good, up to point. But now I'm going to mention how I think that that's great, we've all come back together again, but actually he misread the document. So I'm just going to mention a few things that he didn't notice. So Limbeck seizes upon the eschatological core of the document, accurately situates its eschatological orientation in the context of Catholic debates about the desirability of publicly observing that human nature desires to behold its Alpha and Omega in the supernatural. And yet at the same time, he misses and he strikes out on seeing the resolution of the natural supernatural controversies in the person of Jesus Christ. In keeping with his own Lutheran narrative theology, and eschatological story is taken to function like a futuristic version of predestination, and to determine the uptick of human fortunes without the merely individual intervention of any particular persons, including the second person of the Trinity. Limbeck seems to misread Gaudium et Spes to the extent that he fails to observe its centerpiece, out of which the eschatological conjunction of nature and supernature flows, is Jesus Christ. Limbeck misreads Gaudium et Spes to the extent that he fails to observe that its centerpiece, out of which its eschatological conjunction of nature and supernature flows, is Jesus Christ. And frankly, he never observes it, because his eye is on questions like, is salvation being conceived individualistically, like by Protestant existentialists or by Trent? And he's always asking, is it individualistic or social? And he never asks, is it about Christ? He doesn't, in all the documents I read, he never asks that. He always, his kind of binary thing is it individualistic, which is bad, or is it communal, which is good? And he never asks, is it about Jesus Christ? Which is amazing, considering he's a Lutheran. So, like so many figures of his generation, both Catholic and Protestant, he drops the ball because he's preoccupied with this individual versus social thing, and he doesn't really look at Christ. Many of the Protestant observers at Vatican II were perturbed by what they took to be the optimism of its social and political teachings, along with Henry Brewston and Edmund Schlunk, for example. Lindbeck felt that Gadamer's phase was too optimistic in what it expected from this worldly history. The 1960s was an upbeat decade, and many pessimists have wondered before and since about the pastoral prudence of anchoring magisterial developments in such a tuneful decade as the 1960s. Like John Henry Newman, with respect to the promulgation of papal infallibility at Vatican I, Lindbeck was an inopportunist with respect to Gadamer's phase and its assumptions about social progress. He told George Weigel over Wine and Cigars, no doubt, in 1994, that I had reservations about the document's opportuneness. I was already pessimistic about the state of the world. You could see 68 coming in 65. So, on the one hand, it was a pleasant surprise to see the Catholics magisterially affirming modernity, but on the other hand, a broad affirmation of modernity in that era did not sit right with a young Lutheran professor. So I think, obviously, Lindbeck doesn't note the mixture of pessimistic greys along the orange hues of eschatology in the pastoral constitution. He doesn't see the grey and the orange that's always going on in the constitution, you know, the anxiety and the fear and so on. But I think more importantly, I think he misses that the pastoral constitution uses modernity and modern man as tropes with which to illustrate the human condition. He's talking about modernity in the document in order to analyze the human person who strides on this stage in history. The Constitution, in my opinion, talks about modern times and modernity and modern man in order to ask every individual, well, what's up with you? You know, it affirms the backdrop in which modern people live in order to ask people to interrogate themselves. You know, begin by acknowledging the context and then ask them to interrogate themselves about who they are. It's asking what's up with modern times in order to ask modern people what's up with them. It's discussing the modern times, the ups and downs of modernity, in order to consider the ups and downs of historical human beings. So Gadamer's phase describes the modern world as at once powerful and weak. This absence of blanket affirming optimism leads into the inference that, quote, the imbalances under which the modern world labors are linked with the more basic imbalance which is in the heart of man, end of quote. In keeping with its Augustinian theme of the heart restless until it rests in God, its constant Pascalian evocation of the grandeur and lowliness of man, Gadamer Spes notes that the internal conflicts which each individual experiences are externalized in the way we respond to the modern world. So you have complacent moderns who are convinced that the future rule of man over the earth will satisfy every desire of his heart. And then we have nihilistic moderns who despair of any meaning to life and think that existence is devoid of significance and strive to confer a total meaning on it by their own ingenuity alone. So because modern people are messed up inside, they deal with modern technological progress in messed up ways. That's what the document says. The Constitution teaches that the human being who sidesteps self-interrogation about his own ends and beginnings, about his own purpose in life, either projects the desire of the restless heart outward and makes a sacrament out of technology, or he fixates on technological progress to make up for the meaninglessness of it all. So if you're messed up inside, you're going to have a messed up relationship to progress. That's what it seems to say. So trying to solve the human problem from outside in, rather than from inside out, leads us to turn our social reality into a projection of the human problem writ large. So modernity, with all its engineering masterworks, is a projection of the human problem across the face of the earth in ambivalent technical achievements. That's what the document seems to say. The problem is that we've lost the key to the question, what is man? We do not grasp that as a result of a broken bond to the Creator, and therefore with all our fellow human beings, man is split within himself. As a result of this split, the document says, all of human life, whether individual or collective, shows itself to be a dramatic struggle between good and evil. Indeed, man finds that by himself he is incapable of battling the assaults of evil successfully. But the Lord himself comes to free and strengthen man, renewing and casting out that prince of this world, which held him in the bondage of sin. For sin has diminished man, blocking his path to fulfillment. Now, Lindbeck, you see, never mentions this introspective aspect of the document. Although, in fact, as I see it, all of the eschatology of Gaudium Spes is intended as a response to the historical situation of the human person, who's down in a hole and whose own efforts only admire him further. So the eschatology of the document is meant as an answer to this split within every individual human soul. Gaudium Spes was written by simple Catholic men who had been taught in their catechisms about the four last things. Across the spectrum of theologians who worked on the numerous schemas for the Constitution, from Karol Wojtyła to Monsignor Piolanti, and from Henri de Lubac to Sebastian Trump, eschatology is about death, judgment, heaven, and hell. So paragraph 18 is about the riddle of human existence growing acute in the face of death, and it is boldly Athanasian in its response. Man rebels against death because he bears in himself an eternal seed which cannot be reduced to sheer matter. So the document leads back through the labyrinth of introspection down into the acute questions raised by death, and through that door in the human soul to God. The Church holds that the recognition of God is in no way hostile to man's dignity, since this dignity is rooted and perfected in God. For man was made an intelligent and free member of society by God who created him, and he is called as a son to commune with God and share in his happiness. She further teaches that a hope related to the end of time does not diminish the importance of intervening duties, but rather undergirds the acquittal of them with fresh incentives. When the hope of life eternal is wanting, man's dignity is most grievously lacerated, as current events often attest. Riddles of life and death, of guilt and of grief, go unsolved, with the frequent result that men succumb to despair. So the document contrasts the despairing attitude to modern technological society of secular agnosticism with the positive, hopeful attitude to human progress, which can be seriously entertained only by those who hope in eternity and eternal life. There's no question in the document about balancing optimism and pessimism about social progress. The contrast it makes is between godless despair of the future and Christological hope in eternal life, and therefore hope in this life here below. So, as John Paul II knew so well, the storm center of the eschatology of Gaudium et Spes is paragraph 22. Only in the mystery of the incarnate word does the mystery of man take on light. Christ, by the revelation of the mystery of the Father, fully reveals man to man himself and makes his supreme calling clear, his vocation, his eschatological vocation. The content of the eschatological momentum of history is Christ, and to that extent, the issue of whether it's opportune to be speaking of the presence of the New Jerusalem in the earthly city is off the mark. When we speak of the indwelling of the heavenly city in our earthly human exploits, we do not necessarily envisage the earthly city as a Camelot or as a city on a hill whose harmony with the New Jerusalem is all too clear. We simply mean that Christ, the Lord of history, is present in every stage of the communal biography of mankind. He's present in Samizdat culture, present among the querulous Russian refuseniks, present in the Polish solidarity movement, and so on. Not necessarily just present in successful things. One of the central significant contributions of the Protestant observers to the social documents of Vatican II, one of the great contributions of the Protestant observers, like to the social documents, like Gaudium Spes et Dignitatis Humanae, is the notion of a church as a servant presence in society. Originally proposed by Lucas Fischer, the idea of a servant church was an important inroad in the discussion of how the church can be present in public without dominating the public space. How could one steer between the unworkable integralism of the traditionalists and the liberal reductionism of faith to private opinion? The Protestant observers suggested that the church's servant operates in public, but only wields power through service. Limbeck was well aware of the importance of that maneuver. He speaks of the glimmering of a realistic eschatological answer, as when the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World says that those who dedicate themselves to the earthly service of men make ready the material of the celestial realm and devote themselves to the future when humanity itself will become an offering accepted by God. This suggests that the work of the earthly city is important, not because of what it contributes to the church, but because it supplies material for the kingdom at the end of history. Because God is guiding all the process of nature and history towards the consummation, his people are called to participate in his anonymous humanizing activity, even when they do not thereby win members or Christianize the world in any overt way. That's Limbeck making a decent fist at understanding the document, although somewhat bypassing the incarnation and the church in the way he expresses it. So Limbeck rejects the idea that in Gaudium et Spes, Christ and the church is the means through which God's eschatological action is transforming the history of the world. He claims quite explicitly that the role of the church is diminished in an eschatological perspective, because salvation is conceived not individualistically, but rather in terms of the redemption of mankind as a whole. In order to bring about such a stupendous result, God must be guiding all the process of history towards the goal, not simply working redemptively in and through the church. The people of God is viewed much more than formally as only one of the instruments of God's saving activity. So, Limbeck. I think he's got it wrong here. I do not see what agents could bring about the transformation of history if it's not the individual Christian persons who make up the body of Christ, and through whom the person of Christ acts in history. Limbeck seems there to get confused between salvation as a noun or end product and salvation as a verb or process. Salvation as an end will be social and include our households and animals and so on. That doesn't mean the savers, the agents of salvation, are not individuals and include the one particular church as an individual purpose. So now, in conclusion, because I know I'm running out of time and I'm also running out of space, so don't worry, I'm coming to my conclusion. In conclusion, it is striking that Limbeck believed between 65 and 1970 that the eschatological focus of documents like Gaudium et Spes rendered the Reformation disputes about faith and justification of Scripture obsolete. Later on, he realized that his immediate response to the Vatican II documents had been overly enthusiastic. He came to realize that changes in opinion about doctrines would not overturn the entrenched divisions of the churches. He told Weigel in 94 that the circumstances that would make reunion possible had to do with more than the discovery that these doctrines could be understood without betraying one's own heritage in ways that were not church-dividing. We learned a lot later on. And while we were never naive enough to think that the agreement was all we needed, we did think that a meeting of minds on the 16th century conflicts would make more difference ecumenically than in fact it has. We thought that specific doctrinal issues were more decisive than they proved to be. But in another sense, Limbeck left the council thinking the Reformation was over, and he never wholly went back on that insight. He told Weigel the agreements we reached are one of the conditions for reunion. And while I have no idea when this progress will contribute in some substantial ways to the reunion of the churches, I feel myself a great sense of satisfaction that the job is in large part done. Writing again 10 years later in 2003, Limbeck says, "What if the influence of the Enlightenment on modern and postmodern religious developments is itself coming to an end? What if in the current regnant theologies, anomaly, perhaps in our post-Constantinian yet increasingly globalist age, the visible unity of the Christian churches, no doubt in post-Constantinian forms, will come to seem more and more important?" So in conclusion, let me put Lindbeck's thought like this, or Catholic version of Lindbeck's thought process. Chileism arose early in Christian history and was never fully extinguished by Augustinian interpretations of the Book of Revelation. The medieval church got itself up to its elbows in blood in inquisitorial efforts to stamp out Chileastic eschatology. The Lutheran Reformation was itself an offspring of a counter-ecclesial eschatological spirit. Trent and Tridentine Catholicism responded with rejection. But it found over the next several hundred years that it had to stamp out eschatology at the cost of denying that human beings desire the eternal city at all. The Church thus maintained her social and political order at the cost of denying that the eternal city has any deep relevance to human beings on this earth. Thus, at Vatican II, in Gaudium et Spes, the Church Catholic rebaptized the eschatological impulse, and in so doing raised the bastions between herself and the Protestant churches of the Reformation. So for Protestants like Lindbeck, the Reformation was over. Quote, "The job is in large part done." However, God really does act through the church, and everything the church does has all kinds of intended and unintended consequences. And many other Protestants were stimulated by the church's embrace of eschatology to walk back even further from nature. And this retreat and rejection of nature now stands as a roadblock to ecumenical conversation. Obviously, the last couple of lines with Murphy, not Lindbeck. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And it was a wonderfully stimulating and so much fun. But I think the last sentence, you said something very important in the last sentence about the rejection of nature. And
yes.
There was a lot
okay.
here, but I...
Okay, I just thought I'd toss in a bomb at the end. No, use the word bomb, for God's sake. Lindbeck is kind of right that the eschatological reframing really does change the conversation, even though he kind of messes up on with his anti-individualism and so on. He does mess up with that, but even so... Is it like this? Okay, he does mess up with his anti-individualism. But still, the eschatological reframing is what has brought us together, I think. That's why we're all here together right now. Okay? So it is very important. But supposing what the church says is right, and God really does act through the church in history all the time, and all the stuff the church does has intended and unintended consequences. So the way the world looks right now is the result of things the church has done for the past 2,000 years. And supposing the eschatological document, Gaudium et Spes, has pushed some Protestants into even deeper eschatologism, where they have rejected nature altogether. And that's made ecumenical conversation even more difficult than it was before Gaudium et Spes. You know, I'm thinking of like the more Christ is preached, the more he's rejected. And in some ways, like the more we come towards the Protestants, the more they walk back.
And we come towards the Protestants with our eschatology open arms, and they've just gone further. I was thinking about that idea.
It was just an assertion, but I'm sure that if you think about it, you could see what I mean.
Thanks, Francesca, for that that vigorous and stimulating engagement with Lynbeck, who, as you know, was my teacher and friend.
I didn't look at you once while I was reading.
I kept trying to make eye contact. I think you hit, particularly by bringing in some of his later reflections with Weibel, I think you hit on more of what he was concerned about than I thought you were going to do in the beginning. I have to say, it's not clear to me that Lindbeck was a narrative theologian at all, let alone the father of narrative theology, still more let alone that he got this from Gaudium Spes. But he was an ecumenist.
Have you read those early pieces?
I have read some of them. I haven't read all of them. And I'm happy to be informed by some of what you said. But I have a couple observations about that. One is that Lindbeck's focus on the documents of Vatican II was in the material he quoted, for example, the piece on the Schema 13, was very much oriented by his conversion, I'll call it, that's not his word, that's mine, to an ecumenical vocation at Vatican II. And his deep sense that his calling was to pray and work for a church at once Catholic and Reformed, the Church of John 17, visible to the world, that is at once Catholic and Reformed. So that very much, I think, did guide his engagement with the documents. From that perspective, his lack of comment on the Christology of Gaudium Spes, I wouldn't characterize so much as a misreading as something that wasn't in dispute in his concern with Lutheran Catholic ecumenism. He's offering a reading that's deeply animated by the ecumenical concern that he has, and it's definitely not a complete reading. The other thing I want to observe is that he wrote those pieces like the thing on Schema 13 in order to... Lindbeck was always very audience conscious, and those were written for Lutherans. They were not written for Catholics. And so his address to Lutherans is very much one meant to challenge them. Let's talk about the Reformation is over and so forth. It's not so much, I think, as you characterize it, an immolation of the Lutheran confessions on the altar of the eschatology of Gaudium Spes, as it is a kind of pointed and perhaps exaggerated challenge to Lutherans to come to share in this ecumenical vocation.
But you know, he says, he says this is in the Future of the Church, 1970, the English book. He says that we've abandoned looking at salvation individualistically. We're looking at salvation in this eschatological framework. And that means the city of God, the eternal city, is being built from forces outside of Christianity. Because it's so big that God must be using things bigger than the church. Bigger than Christianity, right? It's so cosmic, it's got to be bigger than merely Christianity. That's what he says in the 1970s book. So, I mean, that means the not mentioning Christ is quite important because it's bigger than merely church and Christianity, right? That's what he says. It's too big for God just to be using the church. And so not mentioning Christ is quite significant here because this is too big just to be Christian. He says that.
Well, sure, but doesn't Gaudium Spes also say the God of Jesus Christ is active everywhere? I take that to be compatible with the point you quote from 1970.
But if you say that and you say Christ is at the center of salvation, then you said something different from just saying God is working everywhere. If you just say God is working everywhere without also saying Christ is our salvation, then you've really said something very different. Haven't you? If you just say, oh, God is everywhere, and you don't mention that Christ is the answer to the human question.
It makes a big difference if you don't say something because you're concerned about saying something else, and if you deny something that you should say. Those are two very different things. Silence, and I'm at this point, I thought you, shall I say, creatively misread him in often taking silence for denial.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Roger.
Thank you.